Hi, I'm Farron Cousins, sitting in for Sam Cedar this week.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Jacobin staff writer Alex Press joins me to discuss her piece in The New Republic, which explores an Alabama Amazon warehouse's fight to unionize and secure more humane working conditions, facing extreme oppositional tactics by one of the most powerful companies in the world.
And don't forget, you can become a member of this podcast over at rofpodcast.com, and it's your support that helps keep this show going. And you can also watch the interviews from the Ring of Fire podcast over on the Majority Report's YouTube channel. Just head over to youtube.com/themajorityreport. And don't forget to subscribe to the Ring of Fire YouTube channel at youtube.com/theringoffire. Now, let's go ahead and jump right in to the biggest news stories of this week. And of course, the biggest news story of the week is the fact that Donald Trump, in his second impeachment trial, was acquitted this past Saturday. Now, I don't think that anybody is surprised that that happened, right? We all knew that's where they were headed. They made it clear in their vote, whether or not to even proceed with it, that we were not going to have enough Republicans going with the Democrats in order to convict Donald Trump and bar him from holding public office in the future. What was a little surprising to a lot of us, though, is the fact that you did have seven Republican senators willing to vote to convict. So that, at least to me, I don't know how you all feel, but I imagine a lot of us were pretty surprised by that because we didn't think it was going to be that many. Honestly, I thought we were going to have some Democrats that wouldn't even go with it. You know, Manchin and Sinema always seem to be kind of riding the fence, never letting anybody know where they stand on anything. So it is what it is. Donald Trump gets acquitted. And then immediately this week following the acquittal, you did have a civil lawsuit filed against both Trump and Rudy Giuliani for their alleged role in inciting the insurrection. They're now being sued in federal court as a civil lawsuit under the Ku Klux Klan Act, which is an 1871 law that basically protected lawmakers from anybody trying to disrupt them from carrying out their constitutional duties. And January 6th, their constitutional duty was to go into the Capitol, certify the Electoral College results. They were not able to do that immediately. Their efforts were hindered by the riot at the Capitol and, of course, inside the Capitol. So, yes, it would seem that that lawsuit is, you know, right on the money with regards to holding these two individuals accountable. Now, before I get into, you know, what the Republican Party has to deal with now, I do want to talk about that lawsuit just for a moment, because to me, it's not the time to file that civil lawsuit, not just yet. And here's why. Nancy Pelosi has said that she wants to impanel a 9/11 style commission to look into the events that took place, you know, who's responsible, who did what, who said what. Basically put this panel together to compile all of the evidence that honestly you would need for the civil trial. So to move forward with the civil trial before you have all the pieces in place, even though you got a really strong case to begin with, you're missing all of the co-conspirators. Okay, there were 11 people who spoke at that rally, at the quote, Stop the Steal rally, before the insurrection actually happened. 11 individuals, and you got two named in this civil suit. You're selling yourself short. You're selling the country short. But don't get me wrong. I mean, I do support this lawsuit. I just really do wish that it would be put on hold for a little bit. There is a lot more intelligence to gather on this particular issue, and I think it would serve the lawsuit well to allow that information to be gathered, especially because this is going to be gathered by the federal government itself. Then your lawsuit has the entire weight of the federal government on your side. That's the best way to ensure success in this lawsuit. And of course, to make sure that we finally have at least a little bit of accountability for these individuals, all of them, not just Trump and Giuliani, but everybody else who was speaking at that rally, all of them get held accountable. If we can't do it criminally, we can at least do it in a civil lawsuit. But again, to me, waiting would have been the best option. I think that gave them the biggest chance for success. But again, they have decided to move forward with it. And I hope that this case succeeds. And again, I think based on the way they filed it, what they've said in their filing with the KKK Act, they have a very strong case. But it could be stronger if they waited. And yeah, it may take a year, it may take a year and a half. But think about that. If you move forward with this lawsuit, you know, not in February of 2021, but say in June or July of 2022, that close to the midterm, put all of this back into the ether, put all of it back into the minds of the public that's about to head to the polls in a couple months to vote for House and Senate and governors across the country, that would be powerful. That would be a great tool to use in these campaigns. Doing the lawsuit now removes that tool from the arsenal, and you know, we'll have to wait and see how that plays out. But there is another thing, obviously, that's going to weigh heavily on the midterms. And this is the main thing I want to talk about, because I think this is the biggest news really over the last couple weeks here. And that is this mass exodus that is taking place within the Republican Party. So over the last few weeks, we have had tens of thousands of voters switch their registrations from Republican to something else. Some are switching to Democrats, some are switching to independents, but either way, they're all switching away from the Republican Party. You have had 33,000 in areas of California alone that were considered more purple. And so you have local officials in California, in these areas where you've got thousands and thousands of Republicans leaving the party, who are now, the Republican officials are now worried that they can't ever win an election again in their district. And this is all according to, by the way, a study from the University of Florida, because there has been such an exodus from the Republican Party since the January 6th insurrection that the researchers at UF decided to look into this, like, hey, how is this going to impact future elections? And they did it in such a great way because, again, they're not just looking at nationally. They're looking at the microcosm. They're looking at the states. They're looking at the individual districts. So when you have a district that is, for all practical purposes, purple instead of solid red or solid blue, losing 5,000 Republicans does change things. And that's the biggest way to change things throughout the country is at the local level. You start small, you build big. And that is what this is doing. Again, 33,000 in areas of California, over 15,000, I think, at this point in the state of Arizona, 10,000 in Colorado, thousands in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Florida. This is happening. We're going to have to wait a while, as per usual, before we see how this does electorally affect the Republicans. But this is headed in the right direction. And again, it's also worth noting that this is happening since the January 6th insurrection. And according to the polls, these people are leaving, the majority of them, because of Trump's actions and because of what the Republican Party now stands for. And that's important because this does tie back to the impeachment. 43 Republicans in the Senate and all but 10 or 11 Republicans in the House voted not to impeach or convict Donald Trump. 60% of the public, in a poll that came out since the impeachment, so just the last couple of days, 60% of the public said we wanted him convicted and we wanted him barred from ever holding public office again. That's a big number. So by voting to not hold Trump accountable, what these Republican legislators did was they pissed off the public. They pissed off a public that is already pissed off at them. The Republican Party has a cumulative approval rating in this country right now today of 34%. 34%. They have lost, I think, about 10 points since November 3rd. The November 3rd, 2020 election, they have lost 10 points of their favorability. The Democrats have gone up. Neither is at 50%, though. They're all both below 50, but the Democrats have a sizable favorability advantage over the Republican Party right now, and there is no indication right now that that is going to shift. Eventually it will. As the researchers at UF said, following an election where your party loses, that party always loses some voters. Now, they have never seen it to the degree that the Republican Party is suffering right now, but to a much smaller degree, it does, in fact, happen. If this continues, and there is a way for it to continue, and I get to that in just a minute, but if it continues, the Republicans are going to be facing just an absolutely unscalable mountain of angry voters in November 2022. Here's the thing that could change that. Now, obviously, you have to deal with the fact that people do move on. You know, George W. Bush is a great example of that. He left office absolutely hated, and now he gets to chill and hand Michelle Obama candy and watch football games with Ellen DeGeneres, right? These people's images do get rehabbed over the years, basically through doing nothing, through disappearing. But Trump doesn't want to disappear, so he's going to be his own worst enemy on that. But if Biden can deliver for the voters, give them the things he promised, the things we need, you know, vaccines. He said this week he's got, hundreds of millions of doses that they have now secured. That's going to help people put their lives back together. It's going to help get us all back to normal, or whatever this new normal is going to be. That's going to help the Democrats and hurt the Republicans. Trump wasn't able to do anything with COVID, with the pandemic at all. Biden's coming in. He's shown some real progress. That's going to help the Democrats again in 2022. Another thing that would help is if he delivered on things like forgiving student loan debt. He mentioned in a town hall this week that he didn't want to go above $10,000. You know, he would do $10,000 of student loan debt forgiven, but no more than that. I think that's a mistake. I think it's a mistake to go ahead and scale down, you know, what the people want, what the people need. It's not necessary yet. You know, don't come to the table to bargain when you've already bargained with yourself down to a much smaller number. He could have come out and said, listen, I want $75,000 in student loan debt of every person up to that amount forgiven. And then sit down and say, listen, my starting number is $75,000. What you got? And then you argue from there. That's what could have happened, but unfortunately has not happened. So we'll see what Biden does. He's been fairly decent on a lot of issues. He's been wishy-washy on others. He's scaled back other promises. So it is kind of up to him. And again, back on the other side, though, the Republicans are in a bit of a identity crisis, if you will. They have to figure out who they're going to be, not just for this next election, but in general, what are we or what are they? They don't know. You've got a couple different factions working right now. Obviously, you have the pro-Trump faction. You know, your Matt Gaetz, your Taylor Greens, your Boberts, your Jim Jordans, and all those folks. They want to be the party of Trump. You know, Matt Gaetz went on Fox News on Sunday after the acquittal, and he attacked Mitch McConnell, accused McConnell of trying to purge Trumpism from the Republican Party. And that's what he said. He's trying to purge Trumpism. And Gaetz can't have that. Gaetz has an absolute, you know, a dangerous obsession with Donald Trump. As I've described over on our YouTube channel, it's almost, in my opinion, like a stalker level. The love that Matt Gaetz has for Donald Trump. And if I were Trump, honestly, I would be concerned about that because it is a dangerous level of devotion. And we've seen that, unfortunately, happen plenty of times over the years with stalkers who believe that I love you. You obviously secretly love me. If I can't have you, nobody can. That's crazy. But, you know, Matt Gaetz is kind of displaying that, at least in my opinion. So, you know, that's not good for the Republican Party. Then, of course, you have the other faction who says, you know what? We don't want to be the party of Trump. We just want to go back to being regular evil Republicans, right? We want to be the party that lies about tax breaks. You want to be the party that pushes for deregulation, that says climate change is a myth and that takes oil money, frack gas money, Wall Street money, big pharma money. That's what we want to be. But this faction has actually held strategy meetings in the past few weeks where they have decided to rebrand themselves as the Party of the Working Class. That's their big goal. That's their strategy, is we're going to convince people that the Republican Party is not the party of Trump, but in fact, the party of the working class people. You know, as long as you ignore the last, 41 years of American politics, sure, I bet you could convince people of that. If as long as they forget all the union busting of the Reagan era, you know, the unwinnable wars that George W. Bush pushed them in, the trickle-down lies of Reagan, Bush 1 and Bush 2 and Trump and all of the other Republicans, yeah. If you ignore all of that, sure, you could paint yourself as the party of the working class. Also, you'd have to make sure the public forgets about your opposition to raising the minimum wage and how you insult low-wage workers. You'd also have to get them to forget about the fact that you're pushing deregulation that actually makes their workplaces more unsafe, and that you consistently side with their employers, you know, when they want to do something that is going to put their workers in harm's way or take away their benefits or deny them the raises that they deserve in their contracts or whatever. Yeah, that's an uphill battle that I don't think Republicans are prepared to fight, at least not with facts and evidence. But I mean, Republicans never come to battle with those things. So again, that's going to be an interesting little story to see how that plays out and if Republicans are successful with that kind of rebranding effort that they're talking about. And then, of course, again, that's just the second faction. So you got a third faction also in the Republican Party that's talking about, well, what if we just go form our own party, right? We got the connections. We got the fundraisers. We know what to do. What if we leave the Republican Party to the Trump people and we just start a new party? Okay, well, that's easier said than done, although I'm not against that. Then, of course, you have the news stories of Trump from a few weeks ago that say he's talking about starting his own political party, the Patriot Party. So you have a Republican Party. Again, I hate to bring up the midterms because they are so far away, but really, they're not that far away. You have a Republican Party split into four different factions right now. Only 31% of people in this country identify as Republicans. 75% of self-identified Republicans think Trump should still have a major say and a major role in the party. So none of these factions are going to get what they want, at least not as a whole. You're not going to have the entire Republican Party being on board. And with only 31% of the public saying they are Republicans, what does that leave you with? That leaves you with a percentage that is incapable, strictly by the numbers, of actually winning an election. So something will change, because you do have plenty of Republicans out there, you know, behind the scenes type people who understand that this kind of thing is not sustainable. You know, they know that the Matt Gaetzes can't have their way. They know that the Mitch McConnells can't have it all their way. So there's going to be some kind of compromise that takes place in this Republican Party to make it into something that is able to win an election. But they are running out of time. And based on the infighting we are still seeing, the level we're seeing it at is increasing, it doesn't look like there's any kind of compromise on the horizon. And as long as they let the real wackos continue to have the microphone, then whatever compromise they come up with isn't going to be anything that is going to be helpful to this country. And that is the biggest news of this week, what the future of the Republican Party holds. So let's go now to Emma Vigeland with some interviews for this week. Emma, take it away.
Thanks, Farron. Hey, everyone. I am here with Alex Press, staff writer at Jacobin and author of The Alabama Town That Could Defeat Jeff Bezos. Her piece is in the New Republic. How are you doing today, Alex?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. And I honestly was just listening to Democracy Now's segment this morning on this very topic, and a lot of what you highlighted so succinctly in your piece was discussed there. But I would love if you could flesh it out for me, because this is a really important fight in terms of a David versus Goliath situation. That's how you refer to it as, and how many people have talked about this fight. Amazon, the second largest employer in the United States, is facing a unionization fight in Alabama, a small town called Bessemer, where employees are banding together and trying to form a union despite intense opposition. Can you talk about and just give us a broad overview, and then we can get into the finer details?
Sure. So I think an important part of the overview is that this facility only opened about a year ago in Bessemer, Alabama. So Amazon, as your viewers might know, has grown incredibly during the pandemic. You know, so many of its competitors, small sort of retailers, have been shut down because of the pandemic, and that money has instead gone to Amazon. So Amazon has been opening up new facilities constantly.
And can I just interject really quickly, because I think the stat that you put in was so interesting, how Amazon added triple the amount of jobs in 2020's fourth quarter than they did in 2019, just to show how much of that dynamic is playing out that Alex is laying out.
Yeah, I mean, it is hard to overstate how much this company has grown. It's sort of like Amazon is eating the world. One financial analyst put it as the pandemic was like a growth hormone for Amazon. So Amazon, even before this year, was already, you know, one of the most powerful and biggest companies in the country and around the world, but now more so than ever. So these workers in Bessemer filed for a union election in November of 2020. Which means that about 8 months after their facility opened, they had already gone to the National Labor Relations Board and said, we want to vote on unionizing. They're organizing with a union that's the RWDSU. That union has pretty good representation in the area among people who work in food processing. So like poultry processing plants in the Bessemer and Birmingham area. And so those, what one distinctive thing about this campaign is that those workers themselves are sort of leading the organizing. Often in organizing campaigns, the union kind of brings in its staff from wherever they might be from to sort of help, you know, have cards outside of the facility, get workers to sign up. And there's nothing wrong with that, but often, you know, it makes it a little easier for the employer to say that the union is an outside force, right? Which is one of the go-to anti-union strategies. Here, these are their neighbors. These are other people from the Bessemer area who are leading this organizing. And a big part of the piece I wrote and of the dynamics of this campaign are that it's explicitly anti-racist. So these are overwhelmingly Black workers at this facility. Bessemer itself is about 70% Black. And I think I highlighted in that New Republic piece is actually that this has a really long history in Bessemer. So even though people sort of hear Alabama and they think, you know, this must be a really anti-union place, it's a right-to-work state, it has low unionization rates. The Bessemer area and the Birmingham area, which is right near it, they themselves actually were once sort of centers of unionization. Alabama at one point had a higher unionization rate than any state today does. It had about 25% of workers organized into unions. And in Bessemer and Birmingham, there were coal miners that were really active in both union campaigns and also politically progressive people. And so those roots, these sort of this old Black industrial class roots, these are people's grandparents, right? These are actually their relatives and ancestors. And so an awareness of those roots, I think, is really present in this campaign, and it makes it really unique. And obviously my hope is that it makes it more effective, that these workers are more likely to win. Something you didn't mention, but obviously should just be clarified for people, because of the pandemic, instead of an in-person vote, the vote is happening through mail-in ballot. So workers are voting on unionizing right now, and they have until March 29th to finish that process.
Right. Although I have two follow-ups to that, because you wrote in your piece about how Amazon used a variety of tactics I want to get into a little later. How is this all not illegal? Because it seems very illegal, including they tried to make them hold some of these votes in person, right? Which is impossible when you're trying to stay safe in the pandemic. Can you talk about that some of those efforts?
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, they're sort of detailed quickly in the piece, but I mean, throughout the past couple months, the reporting has just been one crazy story after the next. So one thing that Amazon has been doing is, through their very anti-union law firm that they hired, they have been petitioning the National Labor Relations Board to delay this election in all sorts of ways. So the first thing they did was argue about the size of the bargaining unit, the number of workers that would be included in the union. And they actually basically won that argument. At first, it was supposed to be only 1,500 workers. And as you see in the piece, it's nearly 6,000 that actually are going to vote. Now, this is good in a sense in that we have more workers who are actually going to be unionized if they decide to do so. The difficult part is that a lot of these are the seasonal workers, the temp workers that Amazon relies on so much. And they're very hard to organize. Imagine people that, you know, only stick around for a few weeks or a few months. You know, that's a lot of work for the organizers to get them on board. But the next thing they did that you mentioned was once they realized that the NLRB was going to go forward with this election, they started saying that it had to happen in person. Now, there's a pandemic, which is what the board said. And Amazon began appealing over the numbers. They said, you know, sure, our county, Jefferson County, where this facility is, had something like a 17% positivity rate, you know, something very dangerous as far as coronavirus. And Amazon said, yeah, but our warehouse has a lower rate. And of course, the board said, yes, but this would be happening in this county. You know, you're asking people to expose themselves. And ultimately, the board ruled against Amazon on this, though not before the company offered to put all of the NLRB people up in their own hotel and hire a bus just for them to keep them safe. All of which the board, of course, said that kind of looks like you're sponsoring us and we're supposed to be neutral here. So we're not going to take a hotel stay from you. But so that was one thing. Now what they've been doing is the sort of standard anti-union campaign. I talked to a labor historian for that New Republic piece who sort of joked that Amazon is getting sort of screwed by their law firm. You know, it's using really stale tactics, standard propaganda that's always been used. So what they're doing is having workers come to meetings that are held by the management of the facility that sort of warns them against voting for the union, tells them, you know, that this will be, they're going to have to pay dues. This is going to make their lives much worse, all but threatening them. Basically, you can't threaten the workers for supporting the union, but you can give your own opinion, right? If you're the employer. They also have had, you know, in the bathrooms of the warehouse, when you sit in the stall right at eye level, are anti-union posters that are put up by Amazon. And I think the craziest thing, which I'm not sure I mentioned in the piece because it hadn't been confirmed, is another reporter, Kim Kelly, who had been reporting from Bessemer for the past few weeks. She actually found out that Amazon had gotten local officials to change the traffic lights at the intersection outside of the warehouse. Union organizers had been standing out there and talking to workers in their cars as they waited for the light to change, because union organizers can't actually go on the property of the facility. And so as it turns out, it's now been confirmed that the officials said, yes, they did actually change the traffic light at Amazon's behest. And this actually caused a car accident that almost hit a union organizer. So Amazon is pulling out all the stops on this.
Yeah, I believe that was broken either last night or this morning by The Verge. That's an incredible story. I want to touch on that with you. I'm glad that you brought it up yourself. But just kind of back to the fact that any of this is legal, this kind of intimidation. We saw the beginnings of this effort in here in New York, where we are, in Staten Island, where organizers, more at the beginning of the pandemic, they tried to form a union, and many of the organizers were fired in retaliation for trying to do that. Now, that is illegal, but yet Amazon is able to get away with it because they have so much power, and they're able to make a case that it wasn't necessarily about organizing a union or forming it. It was about other things. Can you talk about, to the best of your knowledge, that Staten Island effort and how it spilled over into what's happening in Bessemer, Alabama right now?
Yeah. So the RWDSU was involved in organizing that Staten Island warehouse. They never got to the point where they filed for a union election. And so I can't give you the sort of inside. RWDSU hasn't told me sort of the process by which they went from Staten Island to Bessemer. But it is very clear that Amazon, as you say, was very quick to retaliate. You know, they were far less sort of on process to file for an election than what happened in Bessemer. And already the leaders of that organizing were retaliated against. One thing I would say is that I think for people who don't really pay a ton of attention to this stuff, it can seem really shocking. And the reality is that just because something is illegal, it does not mean employers don't do it. So a big problem with labor law in the United States is it's incredibly weak in the first place. It sort of stacks everything against workers and in favor of employers. But on top of that, what laws there are aren't really enforced. So employers, not just powerful ones like Amazon, but actually all sorts of employers, even sort of smaller businesses, frequently retaliate against people for organizing with their coworkers. And, you know, if they ultimately get caught, which requires the workers to file charges against them, to go through the process and to actually win their case, the fine is usually minuscule. So Amazon will get slapped with a few $1,000 fine. And this also happens, I mean, when companies like Amazon are found faulty for workplace fatalities. Amazon has been slapped with tiny fines in facilities where a worker died. And it was proven that it was Amazon's own negligence that caused that death. So I think that's a really important thing to understand. But it's true also that that's the context by which when the workers in Bessemer reached out to this same union, this union, unlike many others, I think already had a sense of what they were up against and an ability to kind of evaluate what this campaign would look like because they had already been organizing in New York.
Right. But I think the new wrinkle is that law firm that you mentioned, right? I mean, the Bessemer unionization process organizing effort got further down the line. And so Amazon got more spooked hiring this firm, Morgan Lewis. I think they're being paid tens of thousands of dollars per day, which, you know, kind of steps on Amazon's argument that they're not able to pay their workers when they're able to spend this amount of money on breaking up the union. Can you talk more about the role of this firm and how it's used, I guess, questionable tactics and what its role is? And I guess Morgan Lewis, they're infamous for this kind of work, no?
Yeah. Morgan Lewis is one of the big ones. So there's a handful of these firms that are union busting law firms that everyone involved in the labor movement, when you hear something like Morgan Lewis, you're like, oh God, okay, this is a serious fight. The polite term for them are management side law firms, but they're union busters. And so the tactics that they're using are, you know, what I've mentioned, which is first trying to stall this case as long as possible. And the reason for that, and the stalling again, is first arguing about the size of the union, then arguing about how the vote's going to take place, all those things, having these consultants come in to help management scare workers away, to help put up flyers opposing the union. And a big part of this process of stalling and scaring is that it's pretty well established that in a union campaign, the more time that the employer has from when the workers file for that union election to when the election is held, the better chance management has, because they have all of this time, the more time they have all of a sudden to start scaring workers. Again, like I said earlier, unions have really circumscribed rights in this process. It really seems like a very unfair process because it is. People, I think, are shocked when they sort of follow one of these campaigns that, you know, why isn't the union allowed on the facility? Whereas the employer is allowed to call workers into meetings on their shift and tell them that the union is bad and that they, you know, all but shouldn't vote for it, you know, or else. But that's just how this process works. And so, I mean, it's a big reason a lot of people in the labor movement want changes to the laws on this. But Morgan Lewis is certainly a key actor here. And they're a well-established player in this process, as far as it's pretty clear what they'll do, and they're doing exactly what's expected of them.
You mentioned in the piece that Amazon has union detection algorithms, or that Bezos has used that kind of tactic in the past. I'm fascinated by this. I'm obviously also deeply disturbed. Can you break down what that tool is that Amazon can use to squash unions based on their own algorithm, I guess?
Yeah. So there was really, that's based on, I think it was Vice that broke this sometime in the past year or so. And it was about Whole Foods, which Amazon owns. And they found out through documents, I think, and emails that had been sent to them, leaked to them, that Amazon, or Whole Foods in this case, has these algorithms that have all sorts of inputs as far as the data. And they generally are about the propensity of workers at a location to organize a union. So some of the data points there are how many unions are in the area, how many other unions, you know, what is the union rate in the area? What is the demographic breakdown of the workforce? Are these minority workers, right? Are these, because I mean, it's pretty understood that, for example, in the United States, Black workers have been the most loyal to unions for a long time. And so Amazon is sort of making these data points proxies for unionization likelihood. Are there workers' centers in the area? What are the politics of the locations existing sort of city or neighborhood? All these things that give them a sense if they calculate it, you know, should they be on the lookout? Are workers here reporting dissatisfaction at a higher rate than at other locations? That might give them a sense that maybe workers are actually talking to each other about their problems and feeling more comfortable voicing discontent. These things are very scary and dystopian, obviously. It really sounds like it's out of a, you know, a sci-fi movie. But this is, you know, Amazon really is the cutting edge of employers that are anti-labor. Other things that have been reported in the past few, in the past year or so, are that Amazon has had the Pinkerton agency on its payroll. The Pinkertons were famous as anti-union mercenaries at the height of, you know, the labor movement 100 years ago, shooting down striking workers. And they still exist. They're a slightly cleaned up, scrubbed version of their old self, but they still do basically the same thing. They help the boss fight the workers. And Amazon, as far as I know, there's no evidence that they have employed them in the United States, but in Europe, they have in fact implanted Pinkerton, you know, members of the Pinkerton agency into workplaces to keep an eye on organizing.
It's unreal. It reminds me of when like Eric Prince, I forget what he changed the name to, but when he tried to rebrand Blackwater, it's like,
yes,
you know, rethink your whole business model before a revamping of how you're perceived. Lastly, I just want to emphasize how impressive and inspiring this worker effort is. Just some of the statistics that that you laid out in terms of what these workers are up against financially. The median household income in Bessemer is just over $30,000. Bezos is worth $184 billion. Median household income in Bessemer is $30,000. That's not, you know, median salary for people. And one in four residents live in poverty. And you also mentioned that 80% of the workers there are Black, I believe, not just people of color, but Black. Mm-hmm. Is that what you said? And yeah. I know that over half are women. So just how all of those things coalesce and how that kind of makes this really Herculean effort to lead the charge in terms of Amazon warehouse unionization.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I'd say in closing is for exactly the reasons you just mentioned, you know, even if me and you don't work in an Amazon warehouse, even if people listening to this don't work in an Amazon warehouse, a win for these workers, if they go union, is a win for every worker in the United States. And I would say around the world too, but certainly in the United States. For all of these reasons, you know, the odds are incredibly against these workers and they've gotten this far. And if they can win this vote, it means that any of us can take on our bosses and win. You know, if you can defeat Jeff Bezos in Bessemer, anything is possible. And I think all of us need that sort of jolt in the arm as far as a sense of the possibilities for the future.
Absolutely. Alex Press, staff writer at Jacobin, author of The Alabama Town That Could Defeat Jeff Bezos. That's in the New Republic. Thank you so much, Alex, for taking the time to talk to me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's it for another week of Ring of Fire. Are you still subscribed to the free show? Head over to rofpodcast.com and support the show by becoming a member. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and watch all of our videos on YouTube. Just go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And you can check out Sam on his daily show, The Majority Report. Just go to majority.fm for his daily live stream covering all of the biggest news stories of the day. For Emma Vigeland, I am Farron Cousins in for Sam Cedar, and this has been Ring of Fire. I know the score at the back of my hand. Them other boys, I don't give a damn. They kiss on the ring. Break me down.